from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Ebola dismay, a wild stock market, midterm politics heat up, tough questions about American Ebola readiness on Capitol Hill yesterday. Republican Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania said early assurances from the CDC are not holding up.
We have been told, quote, virtually any hospital in the country that can do isolation for Ebola, unquote. The events in Dallas have proven otherwise.
A 460-point plunge in the Dow before Wall Street battled back some on Wednesday. CNBC's Bob Pisani.
These are jaw-dropping moves. We haven't seen this in a long, long time here. There were plenty of problems. We had very disappointing retail sales numbers that weighed on everything.
And fans and faint praise on the midterm trail. Kansas Republican embattled Pat Roberts was asked in debate what positive thing he could say about his independent Senate challenger, Greg Orman.
I would say that you are a very well-dressed opponent. I admire your accumulation of wealth.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kristen Welker, Molly Ball, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us now from Washington is Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
And from Washington, Molly Ball is here, national political writer for The Atlantic. Molly, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Hey. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kristen, and Molly.
We have no choice but to plunge right in on Ebola. We heard a lot on Capitol Hill yesterday. We're seeing a lot all over the place. World Health Organization saying today that it has botched attempts to stop the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. I guess, to say the least, we thought it would be fast and clean and done here, kind of put a teacup over it, but that's not how it's turning out. Some of the most compelling testimony of the week, and informal, but the nurse, you guys must have heard her out of the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. This was Brianna Aguirre, very brave, coming forward to say that it was just a mess there. She had helped take care of the first nurse who contracted Ebola on the Today Show, NBC's, on Thursday. She said it was just a mess. Inadequate protective gear, lab specimens mishandled, garbage piled up in the hallways. She was asked if she would go to that hospital, her own, if she became symptomatic with Ebola. She did not mince words.
Knowing what I know, I would try anything and everything to refuse to go there to be treated. I would feel at risk by going there. If I don't actually have Ebola, I may contract it there, is how I actually feel. And I would do anything to refuse to go there.
Anything to refuse to go to my own hospital. America's looking around these days. Kristen Welker, what is going on? We were given the impression that this country was ready, the health system was ready. We would kind of just, you know, put a quarantine over Ebola wherever it showed up, and that would be that. Now we're chasing people on more than one flight. We've got a report here of somebody who handled specimens at Texas Health Presbyterian who's now gone off on a cruise ship. They're worried about that. And you've got 70-some in the hospital who were potentially exposed. What do you see happening, Kristen?
Well, I think you're right. And the interview with the nurse was just stunning. And I think continued to sort of send shockwaves throughout the country. I think the administration has acknowledged there have been missteps. There have been mistakes and some breaking news overnight. I was in the Oval Office with President Obama last night when he spoke about this after meeting with some of his top advisors. And he announced that he is seriously considering appointing an Ebola czar, someone to be the face of this, someone
in response to your question, Kristen, I think.
Because right now it looks like the government doesn't have a handle on this. And in talking to people with knowledge of this, they say, look, this announcement can't come soon enough. We don't have timing from the White House. We don't know who that person is going to be. But there was a real sense that no one was in charge that week. And I think that was a problem for this administration. And politically, it was a problem. Democrats want the president to look like he has a handle on this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of the reason why he felt the need to appoint an Ebola czar. We expect that announcement to come sometime soon, although we don't have exact timing, Tom.
The president's comment coming in response, I believe, Kristen, to your question. I mean, Molly,
that's
people
right.
People say don't panic, and that is quite right. On the other hand, a country should be able to expect performance here and competence here, and it was not a mystery that this was building in West Africa. I mean, where's accountability and where is performance? Do you see it coming together now, Molly?
Yeah, well, as a lot of people have noted, a man in a white coat standing in front of a bunch of cameras saying there's nothing to worry about, we've got this under control, that's the way a lot of zombie movies start. So, when people continue to see a situation that does not seem to be under control, it's not very comforting to be told repeatedly not to panic. And that question of competence, that question of from the White House to the WHO, does anyone have a handle on the situation? Is anyone in charge? I think has really led people to be very nervous about this. And as a political question, because I'm out there on the campaign trail mm-hmm. and seeing a lot of candidates talking about this, the first candidates to talk about this were actually Democratic candidates who tried to blame Republicans for stopping funding for preparedness. But it's really Republicans who have made a case that this is a part of a larger narrative about this administration not being able to handle crises, whether it was the IRS scandal, agencies out of control, or something like healthcare.gov, where, a years-long project for a major policy initiative wasn't ready on time and didn't work when it was rolled out. There's a sense that, if you look at polls, people have lost confidence in the president. People have lost trust in the administration. And this is another piece of that narrative. This is another piece of evidence that this is a White House that is scrambling, is reactive, is always a little bit behind the eight ball.
Jack, but it fits then into a pattern that we know so well. First, cut the funding for public health. Then you get a crisis, blame it on the White House. I mean, I'm not saying this has been a perfect response. Far from it. But there are many sides to this equation, Jack.
That's true, and the parlous condition of the public health system is clearly thrown up here in stark relief. Nevertheless, you can't get away from it. Dr. Frieden, just a few weeks ago, quote, "Any hospital in the country can safely take care of Ebola." That was a recklessly inaccurate statement. In fact, we know now that there are only 4 hospitals in the country that are state-of-the-art biocontainment hospitals, and those 4 hospitals among them have 9 beds, of which only 6 are now open. Meanwhile, 70 members of the Texas Presbyterian staff are being monitored for signs of Ebola. So there are 6 open beds in state-of-the-art hospitals. All of this should have been known and was known. And one wonders here, to get to Molly's point, was the chief of staff at the White House on the phone to Dr. Frieden weeks ago saying, look, we don't want any problem here. We want you to be all over this. This is fear. We can't have panic in the country. Did that phone call take place, or did they just simply leave this to the experts? There's a feeling about this administration. The president has said, we get the policy right, and we don't look after the politics so much. Maybe they need to reverse those things and think about politics. Politics, after all, is the confidence people have that the government is working. Leaders convey it, and through performance they manifest it. Not in this administration, recently.
Yeah, maybe not, but Kristen, I mean, of course politics will be made of this. Molly Ball sees it happening on the trail right now, but you've got to have a country, supposed to be a great nation, with a well-put-together health and public health system to have something for the White House to sort of send forth to address a problem like this.
That's right. And to Jack's point, we had Dan Pfeiffer, one of the president's top advisors, just recently saying that they've been preparing for this for 7 months. Well, if they have been preparing for 7 months, why the mistakes in Texas? Why the messaging that was off and incorrect? And why did they say that hospitals across the country were prepared to deal with this when they, in fact, weren't? And I think the problem that they're dealing with now is the fact that the fear factor throughout the country is very real. And now the president needs to get out in front and needs to reassure the American people. You have schools closing, and again, the cruise line where you have the one person who's now locked away in her cabin. I mean, this fear factor is a very real thing and could impact the midterms. I've been speaking to Democratic sources who say they're concerned that this could really hurt Democrats in the midterms. Obviously, Democrats already fighting an uphill battle as they try to hold on to the Senate. There's a lot of concern that if the White House doesn't get on top of this, this could end their chances of trying to hold on to the Senate.
I mean, Molly, don't panic. And again, that is exactly right. But show us through performance that there's no reason to. How potent is it? Is this the October surprise that may twist that balance for Capitol Hill's control?
Well, in a way it is. And I just want to go back to your earlier point about the public health funding. In fact, it is the Obama administration that has proposed less funding for public health than the Bush administration did. And Congress has actually passed more funding for public health than this White House requested.
Wow.
So it's not correct to simply blame Republicans for what is a real decline in funding for public health in the United States. It's a complicated situation, but it's not that clean cut. To your question, I think this is a larger sense of fear that people have. I've been listening to focus groups of undecided voters, and when you talk to people, voters out there, there is a creeping sense of unease that has a lot of sources. And even before the Ebola issue came home to roost in the United States, it was all the crises abroad. It was ISIS and beheadings and the sense of a world on fire. And pollsters will tell you, when people are afraid, when people are concerned about their security, they will tend to vote Republicans.
Wall Street caught a little bit of that this week. Molly Ball, please stand by there in Washington with The Atlantic. Kristen Welker with NBC. We've got to take a short break here. Jack Beatty, please stand by. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking, looking at a week in the news this hour, Ebola and shaken confidence there, wild markets, oil price plunge, midterm fireworks, with Molly Ball, national political writer for The Atlantic, Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News, and our own Jack Beatty. Word out that the new czar, Kristen, you put the question, the president said maybe, today yes, there will be a czar, it will be Ron Klain, K-L-A-I-N. This is a former chief of staff to Vice President Joe Biden, to Al Gore when he was VP. Does not have a health care background, but said to be good manager, good relations in the administration and Capitol Hill. Kristen, what do you know about the new Ebola czar? What a title. Ron Klain.
That's right. Well, and I just confirmed that with my sources that he will be the new Ebola czar. He's chief of staff to two vice presidents, Al Gore, Joe Biden. Look, this is someone who has a lot of experience in management. That is what the White House wants right now. And if you talk to political analysts, they say the way to handle this is the way that the administration handled the BP oil spill. Remember, it looked initially like they were responding to that, didn't have a grip on that situation. Then they named Thad Allen to be the head of that response. That's what they're doing by naming Ron Klain. They want someone to essentially be the face of government responsibility. They want to turn this around and put someone out there so that they deal with this issue of the public fear, the questions about mismanagement and the mistakes that were made.
Here we've got the president talking about the Ebola czar after Kristen put a question to him at the White House.
It may make sense for us to have one person, in part just so that after this initial surge of activity, we can have a more regular process just to make sure that we're crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's going forward.
Get on it. Lace up. Ida in Pacific Grove, California is calling. Ida, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I am a retired public health nurse, and I actually worked in public health for 13 years before public health doesn't hardly exist anymore in many ways. I think the reason or the way to stop the panic that I see happening is through education.
Education of who? Of hospital administrators and doctors and nurses, or education of the public?
All of those. All of those. Nurses, doctors, and why are we having a judge be the coolest person around telling us what's going on?
In Dallas, yeah, they brought in a judge. Hey, Ida, you're in California. What about public health there? Is it a federal funding problem? Is it a state funding? What happened there?
Now, I have to say I'm not current, but I think history is very important. I was in Pasadena City Health Department, which is one of few city health departments in California, and I worked in several health departments in California, in San Francisco, and in Los Angeles. And in 1977, we had Proposition 13, which was for taxes on our property, property taxes. And the result of that proposition passing, half of the public health nurses in Los Angeles County were laid off.
Ida, we've got it. I mean, that's deep history, but it does set a table. History is important. I mean, you sort of, at some point, you get what you pay for, but then you have to manage it well as well. Ida, I appreciate your call from Pacific Grove. I mean, this back to the funding question, and Molly, we hear you there. Ida's looking at her own home state. Let me get one more right here. Jane in Boston.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling to suggest that instead of either completely stopping air traffic from affected areas coming into the U.S., or allowing traffic to come into many different airports in the U.S., is it not possible to designate certain airports, certain hubs, particularly those near NIH-approved facilities, to be the receiving airports for those passengers who are coming from stricken areas?
Jane, let us pick it up. I mean, that is sort of what they're doing. These four airports where they are doing testing now get an overwhelming majority of the flights, passengers coming out of West Africa. I mean, the calls have been for something wider. Here was Republican Fred Upton of Michigan questioning why the administration hasn't instituted travel ban on West African countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea.
No, you're not coming here. Not until this situation, you're right, it needs to be solved in Africa, but until it is, we should not be allowing these folks in, period.
Kristen Welker, this keeps coming up. It came up a lot in the grilling yesterday of the CDC. What about closing down travel? Is this a real option? Is it something that serious people are saying the country should look at? Is Europe doing it?
Well, I thought the other headline that got lost a little bit last night, Tom, because we were talking about this Ebola czar, is that President Obama said last night, I'm not philosophically opposed to a travel ban. He opened the door just a tiny bit to the possibility that his administration could be looking into a travel ban. Having said that, they're not willing to go there yet. Why? Because experts are saying if you put a travel ban into effect, it ultimately could make it harder to track the people who do have temperatures. People could start lying about where they're
sneaking
coming
around,
from.
Sneaking around, yeah.
And you basically hamper the U.S. ability to deal with the crisis at its root in West Africa. So that is the argument for not imposing a travel ban. But you're right. There are more and more lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, who are saying we need to take this seriously. Al Franken among them saying we need to really seriously consider a travel ban. I think last night the president was saying, you know what, I'm not taking it off the table.
Beverly in Watertown, Massachusetts. Beverly, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to have a chance to speak about this. I am a public health professional, although retired, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make a couple of points. One is that the nurse from California made the first point I was going to talk about, the importance of universal education. So I don't have to talk about that.
Yeah, okay.
I also want to say, though, since the travel ban has come up, as someone who, in fact, has studied epidemiology, I'm not an epidemiologist, I have studied it and had to because of having to study it for my public health degree.
Beverly, cut to the chase. What's your point?
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
What is?
Unnecessary.
What?
The argument has been made against it on your show just now. Fine. My problem is that the route to protecting this country from Ebola lies in the source, that is to say, the place where it is epidemic, Africa.
So go and deal with West Africa. I mean, the plans are out there this week to do that. Beverly, thanks for calling. Far short of what's required, the World Health Organization saying we've botched it so far. Molly, we've got this National Guard and reserves call up now with potentially more American soldiers going there. Does that look politically popular? Beverly's point, go and fix this at the source where there's nearly 5,000 dead now and still talk about exponential growth and really no boundary put around it.
Well, and this is something that has been done, right? We have sent troops and other assistance to West Africa. And you do hear some making the counterargument, oh, we need to be focused on what's happening here at home. Why help those people in Africa when there are people here who need help? There's even in the sort of right-wing fever swamps some conspiracy theories saying they're sending American troops to West Africa in order to get Ebola and bring it back here and cause a crisis, which, of course, is ridiculous. I think there's a conflicting feeling, especially among an American public, that that just does want to close the borders, not let anyone in. That's not realistic, as all of the experts have said. You can't stop people from going in and out of the country. You can't put the whole country on lockdown, especially with the situation that we've seen so far, which does not constitute an outbreak, which constitutes a situation that is frightening and doesn't seem to be under control, but at this point really is still only two cases. So as Kristen said, you know, the administration is trying to signal that it is open to whatever has to be done, but that it is still trying to respond in a way that is proportional to the actual domestic threat of this.
Americans,
Tom, can I jump in?
Yes, please.
One of the main strategies of the Obama administration right now is to get a robust international response. So the president has been on the phone with international leaders saying this needs to be an all hands on deck response. And we've sent about 4,000 U.S. forces, or at least we're deploying about 4,000 U.S. forces. And now we're saying to other countries like Britain, like France, you need to send more supplies, more medical personnel who can help out, because as we've been saying, it's just not enough. And your caller's absolutely right. This needs to be addressed at the root. And I think there's broad agreement about that.
All kinds of news this week. Ebola sort of shadowing, but lots going on. Norm in Indian Land, South Carolina. Norm, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. You talked about it a couple weeks ago, but the siege of Kobani, the valiant defense by the Kurds, it's being completely steamrolled over by the Ebola crisis, which is totally important. But otherwise, this would be, I think, one of the biggest stories going in the world, where the Syrian Kurds, our boots on the ground, are basically fighting this gallant fight against ISIS. And with our help with the airstrikes, it seems in the last few days, they're pushing ISIS out of the town of Kobani. I'm just amazed. Unless you go online, it's almost like dead silence.
Yeah, no, the Ebola headlines are huge, but we have paid attention to Kobani. Lots of people watching that. And this week, not just Kobani, but also inside Iraq, Anbar, ISIS very close to Baghdad. There's a lot going on that front. Last Sunday, talking with Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press, we had National Security Advisor Susan Rice. She was asked about Turkey's current role in the U.S.-led fight. She suggested, this stood up for about 5 minutes, that Turkey was going to allow the U.S. to use air bases there, which would have made covering Kobani much easier. Here's a bit of that.
The Turks have, just in the last several days, made a commitment that they will, in the first instance, allow the United States and our partners to use Turkish bases and territory to train...
Airspace too, by the way?
Hold on, let me explain this carefully. To train these moderate Syrian opposition forces.
Well, that may be, but one day later, Turkish officials said no deal was reached on the use of that Turkish base. Complicated politics there. Turkey doesn't want Kurds empowered. They're holding out for more from the U.S. And, of course, the fighting has continued to roll in Anbar right up toward Baghdad. Here's a little bit from Elizabeth Palmer of CBS News. Right there outside Baghdad, and you can hear her. She says, well, the line is static at the moment, but then listen.
ISIS fighters are just a couple of miles in the trees over my shoulder, but the front line is static. Neither side is moving forward or back, just trading occasional fire.
Yeah, right there. And the president, with the defense chiefs from all over the country, 20 partner nations at Joint Base Andrews, this was on Tuesday, saying this is going to take time.
This is going to be a long-term campaign. There are not quick fixes involved. We're still at the early stages. As with any military effort, there will be days of progress, and there are going to be periods of setback.
Setback, long-term. Jack Beatty, what do you see going on this conflict front?
Well, our caller is right. There has been some good news from Kobani. There's a sharp step up of U.S. strikes. and some evidence that there's been coordination between people on the ground with the Kurdish resistance and our flyers or our traffic, whoever it is directing the combat, and it's worked. At least they have pushed ISIS forces out of some parts of the area, but by no means is it safe. And this week, of course, we got a sort of X-ray into the complexity of this Kobani problem when Kurdish PKK guerrilla leaders in Turkey said, look, unless the Turks help break the siege of Kobani, this was when it looked dire just earlier this week, we're going to go back into fighting. For 5 years, they've been negotiating with the Turkish government, and it's been part of the Turkish president's, premier's efforts to, you know, work that problem in Turkey. And he says, we're ready to go back to fighting. So it was as if the ISIS assault on Kobani was going to open up another front of instability in Turkey. And meanwhile, what do we have the administration doing? Sending Susan Rice onto television. You know, that those should be the worst news in American politics. Send Susan Rice onto television. I mean, whenever she appears, there is some effort to sell people on things that just things just aren't so. And here she was trying to, you know, say, oh, we have a coalition and it's going. Listen, a coalition, as somebody writes today, it's Uncle Sucker. We're the coalition. One country, I think it was Slovakia or Slovenia this week, said, you know, we've been put on the list by the State Department. We haven't agreed to do anything. Another country said, we're on the list, but we're giving $25,000. This is another one of those sham selling points to the public that, oh, we're not in this alone. Oh, God, if only that were not the case.
Kristen Welker, weigh that for us. The president spent a bunch of time with defense ministers from a lot of countries this week just outside Washington. How does the coalition effort look to you, the effort overall, Kristen?
Well, look, I think that's right. I think that the administration has gotten some assurances from some countries that they're going to join in airstrikes, that they will send supplies and other type of support. But it's absolutely right that Turkey has pulled back on any assurances that it may or may not have been signaling to the administration. And without Turkey, the coalition falls apart a little bit. The administration needs their support in terms of using its air bases. But the bigger question, and I think where the conversation heads, who's going to put troops on the ground? The administration says it's not going to be U.S. boots. Well, how do you convince Arab nations to put boots on the ground when the United States is not going to do that? So far, no countries have come forward and said that they're going to put boots on the ground. And if you talk to military officials, they say that's key to getting the upper hand on ISIS.
Molly Ball, is this playing hot on the campaign trail in the midterms? What's going on with ISIS, Syria, Iraq, or not?
Oh, absolutely. And this is a big talking point for Republican candidates. Now, there are divisions within the Republican Party, as we've talked about before. There, you do have some Republicans who are not as hawkish as the traditional Republican stance. But in this case, you know, even Rand Paul, who's sort of the archetype of the libertarian non-interventionist Republican, has supported the airstrike campaign. And we have heard when Congress was here to pass the authorization for this action, a lot of calls from the Republican Party to go further, that we were going to need ground troops. And we're going to hear more of that after the election when Congress comes back and wants to have more of a say in what's going on overseas, particularly given that this effort, I think there was a sort of crossed fingers hope when it was originally announced that we could get in and get out, do the airstrikes and vanquish them. And that might not have been realistic. But now that we're hearing this is going to be a longer, more intensive effort, you're going to hear more and more calls for more involvement and for ground troops.
Nothing quick about what's being described now. Molly Ball with The Atlantic, please stand by. Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Jack Beatty, this is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, NBC's Dr. Nancy Snyderman, back from West Africa, was spotted in the parking lot of a New Jersey restaurant last week, violating quarantine after coming in contact with a confirmed Ebola case. She'd gone for takeout. She apologized. Many were dismayed. On ABC's The View, Whoopi Goldberg said, "Come on, Doc."
That's why they make a telephone. Maybe, Nancy, you don't know that. But I'm going to hit you. Because there's a device, right?
Yeah.
There's a device you can call and say, hey, could you deliver?
Yeah. Observe the quarantine doctor. HBO announced it will, oh, no, Apple and Facebook added egg freezing to employee benefits. Women at the companies will have the option of putting off pregnancy. The procedure can cost up to $20,000. Jordan Powell works in Silicon Valley.
I'm assuming it's because women want to enjoy their 20s by working and then move on from there. I think it's kind of crazy. I don't think I personally would opt to go down that route, but I certainly know some people that are pretty cutthroat these days that probably would.
Okay, and here we go. HBO announced it will offer standalone internet streaming of its programs in the U.S. next year. No cable subscription required, giving viewers the option to cut the cord, skip the full cable package, and still see Game of Thrones.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
We're looking at a week in the news. Ebola and shaken confidence there. Wild markets, oil plunge, midterm fireworks. Kristen Welker is with us from NBC News. White House correspondent there, Molly Ball, national political reporter for The Atlantic. You can join us. Did the Pentagon turn your head with its report on climate change, saying it is now a national security threat right now? Are you freezing your eggs at Apple, cutting your cord for HBO Go, rooting Kansas City or San Francisco in the World Series? What about those midterms? Politics all over, some pretty tough this week. I spent 4 years in Hong Kong. A lot of sympathy for those kids and more who've been out in the streets there. A lot of dismantling of that going on today and some real beatings there. Brave, brave protesters calling for a little more democracy in Hong Kong. People in the streets in this country as well. In St. Louis, back in Ferguson, activists, religious leaders, Cornel West was there for what they called Ferguson October. West got arrested along with about 50 others. One man on the streets of Ferguson explained why he was still protesting.
My message is we got to be out here. We got to support. We got to be out all the time, and it can't just be this. It has to be when our students, when our young people are pushed out of schools, when they are pushed into prisons, when they are pushed onto the streets, when they are pushed into the grave. We have to be out here for them.
Still out over the weekend in the rainy streets of Ferguson. Let's hear from our listeners. CD in Detroit, Michigan. CD, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests.
Hi.
I have a broader question from just a political standpoint as far as how we're saying the world is on fire and how this administration is responding to all of these crises. I guess the default position has been is that Republicans are going to run away with the midterm elections. And, you know, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. What I want to know is anyone asking the question about how they would respond any differently? How are we just to assume that the classic decentralized government or free market, healthcare system would handle these problems any better or worse? Or is there any specifics out there about what would be different if this administration, which is, you know, admittedly not doing things very well, but what would be different under a different administration?
CD, it's a great question, deeper than the headlines, and I like it. Molly Ball picked that up. Is that a question people are asking? Do they just, first of all, do you see a runaway one way or the other here? And how are people assessing this? Do they say, oh, Republicans have the right way to go at these things or not?
It's a very good question, and it's one that I've been asking a lot of Republican candidates because you hear these two different messages often back to back from the Republicans who are running, particularly for the Senate. On the one hand, they say, you have to send me to the Senate to stop the Obama agenda, put Republicans in the majority in the Senate so that we can stop this administration's, you know, creeping socialism or whatever they want to call it. On the other hand, they're saying, send me to Washington to end the dysfunction, to stop the stalemate, to make Washington work again, and to form bipartisan compromises. Well, those seem to me to be the opposite thing. And so I've asked a lot of Republicans, how do you reconcile that? And what they're saying is that not actually a disjunctive message, because once you had consolidated Republican control of Congress, they would be able to find common ground with the White House on some of the things that Republicans and the president actually agree on, things like tax reform, entitlement reform, maybe even a Republican version of immigration reform, which of course has been stalled. And they're hoping also, and this is possibly a vain hope, that if Republicans do very well in the midterms, which is increasingly looking like it's going to be the case, although it's not a done deal, that will sort of send a message to the White House that this is what the country wants, that this is sort of the mandate from the public. And so the White House will have to come to the table. Democrats will have to come to the table in acknowledgement of that, and there will be more room for consensus to be formed. I don't think Republicans are a lock to take the Senate majority, but we've seen a lot of polls turning in their direction in the past past week or two in the states that they need to win, in places like Arkansas and Louisiana and Kentucky, and the places that they would certainly be helpful for them to win, like Iowa and Colorado. So it's still very close in a lot of these states, but Republicans are feeling very, very confident after this week.
Fascinating. Just a week or two ago, people were talking about things trending maybe the other way. Kristen, how's the White House looking at the prospects for the midterm outcome and the possibility of working with an all-Republican Capitol Hill?
Well, I think they're prepared for that possibility. What's interesting is if you look at the polls, there's just a general dissatisfaction with Washington, particularly with Congress. Congress's approval rating is lower than President Obama's. So I think there are still some toss-ups, and there's still some possibility for Democrats to hold on to the Senate. And I think the White House, if you ask anyone here, says, no, no, Democrats are going to hold on to the Senate. And of course, you would expect them to say that. What's interesting is that President Obama, who was going to begin campaigning, by the way, this week, is largely sitting out of the main event. He's not going to be campaigning for members of Senate or for people who are vying for those Senate seats. Instead, he's really only going to be stumping for gubernatorial candidates. And I think his main role in this race is going to be as a fundraiser. He's still one of the best fundraisers out there. And so I think he's going to be sitting this one out because his approval ratings are hovering around the mid to low 40s.
A lot of money flying out there from both sides. We saw a new ad rolled out. This was Tuesday from American Crossroads, the big GOP-aligned super PAC co-founded by Karl Rove, launched an attack ad tying Democratic Senator in New Hampshire's Jean Shaheen to President Obama. A girl on stage at a spelling bee struggles with how to spell Shaheen's name.
Shaheen. O-B-A-M-A.
Close enough.
Say the judges. Talk about tying it right to the president. And here in Kentucky, Democrat U.S. Senate candidate who's done look pretty good in the polls, Alison Lundgren Grimes, isn't going to tell you who she voted for in the last presidential election, no matter how many times you asked. Moderator Bill Goodman of Kentucky Educational Television tried at a Senate debate Monday.
Why are you reluctant to give an answer on whether or not you voted for President Obama?
Bill, there's no reluctancy. This is a matter of principle. Our Constitution grants here in Kentucky the constitutional right for privacy at the ballot box, for a secret ballot.
But things slippery on lots of sides in lots of ways. Same debate, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, of course, the Republican leader in the Senate, talking about health care and said that his state's rather popular health care exchange could stay, but Obamacare has to go.
Kentucky Connect is a website. It was paid for by $200-some-odd million grant from the federal government. The website can continue, but in my view, the best interest of the country would be achieved by pulling out Obamacare root and branch.
Molly, can Kentuckians have the website and get rid of Obamacare? Isn't the website the face of Obamacare?
Well, they might be able to have a website, but there wouldn't be anything behind it. The website, of course, is the face of the exchange that in Kentucky's case is a state-based exchange rather than healthcare.gov. But it's like saying you could repeal Obamacare and keep healthcare.gov, and it would just be a website where, you know, insurance companies advertise. It's really pretty meaningless if you take that away, especially since, as McConnell himself said, it would be hundreds of millions of dollars that the state would have to spend to replicate what the federal law pays for behind that website. So, you know, this is a tough spot for Republicans that do have well-functioning Obamacare exchanges in their states. In a lot of states, Obamacare is very unpopular, but the Medicaid expansion is popular where it's been implemented, and the exchanges have made insurance accessible to a lot of people who didn't have it before. And this is going to be something that I think we're going to hear more about after the elections as Republicans come under increasing pressure, especially if they have the majority, from their base to repeal Obamacare, where they might prefer, and the sort of conventional wisdom, at least in private among Republicans, is that Obamacare is here to stay, and the best they can hope to do is to tinker with it and to try to quote-unquote fix it. That's something that's not going to sit well with some Republicans who want to see it ripped out, as McConnell said, root and branch.
Jack Beatty, you've been blazing through the midterm debates all over on C-SPAN. What do you see? What are you hearing out there, Jack?
Well, I hear one word again and again, and we heard it in that ad for Jean Shaheen. against Jean Shaheen, Obama. In the Arkansas debate, Tom Cotton used the word Obama 50 times in 90 minutes. And all in Louisiana, I mean, Obama is on the ballot whether his name is there or not. He is, according to CBS polls, 31% of registered voters see the election as a way to protest the president, only 18% as a way to affirm him. And all of this, of course, the way that somehow this name has become toxified, it speaks to a crisis, I think, in the White House's communication strategy. You know, Paul Krugman, writing in, obviously he's a fan of Obama's, but writing in the current Rolling Stone, lays out the administration's record in terms of the economy mostly. And just looking at the numbers, it is a pretty good story. Months of steady job growth, not enough, but the trend upward, and, you know, all until this week at least, a very good stock market. But that story simply hasn't got over. The president hasn't succeeded in putting it over, and none of the Democratic candidates that I have seen has said so much as a word about the president, you know, a positive about him. Mark Udall, in some of his ads before the interloper into the White House, was saying, I'm the last person they want to see walking up the White House driveway. Well, no, quite not Mark, but just the way suddenly the name Obama has become poison for Democratic candidates.
Of course, we've got people online that look maybe Democrat just laying out ream after ream of accomplishments they want people to look at. You would think the Democratic politicians would want to talk about those, but maybe it's just too tough. Charles in Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, thanks for calling. You're on.
I'd like to just give a little explanation of why Allison won't say who she voted for.
Yes, please.
If she does, then all we'll hear is those words coming out of her mouth over and over on one of these attack ads from McConnell and all his cohorts. And, you know, I'm not pleased with Allison because she hadn't been progressive enough, but...
But you get it, politically.
Yes, totally. You know, that's the whole problem. And, you know, she's correct that it's a private ballot. It really is.
Well, that's true, but is it hurting her not to say, or you think it would hurt her more if she just laid it out there and then the campaign ads went to town?
Oh, it would hurt her way worse because they love to just take seven words, I voted for President Obama or something, you know, however many that is, or six, and that's...
Hit the repeat button. Charles in Lexington, Kentucky, I appreciate your call very much. Dale in Franklin, Tennessee. Dale, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. I'm a little taken aback and puzzled by Molly's comments regarding the gentleman that had the very good question as far as, you know, in the midterms, what is it that the Republicans would offer that would be different?
Or better, and, or not better, yeah.
Right, right, exactly. And then at some point she said something to the effect that, well, you know, the president and the Democrats are going to have to sort of come to the table. I don't remember exact words, but I'm thinking that's a fantasy because all along all I've seen is, you know, deliberate non-compromising and non-cooperation from the obstructionist party. So I'm not sure what she means by that.
All Republican Capitol Hill, what's to say that's going to bring out some bipartisanship? It hasn't worked the other way, many would say, Molly.
Oh, absolutely. And to be clear, I was presenting the answer that I get from Republicans when I ask them that question. I'm, of course, as skeptical as you are that it would actually happen. But if there is a case to be made that that actually could happen, if we're being really pie-in-the-sky optimists about this, I think the case is that right now, with the House and the Senate in separate hands, no one is accountable for what Congress does. In fact, both parties have an incentive in Congress not getting anything done because nobody is going to get the credit for it. Whereas if control of Congress is consolidated under one party, then instead of blaming just Washington when Congress does something bad, it's that party that is to blame because they control both branches of the Congress. So, and there are also a lot of Republicans. I was speaking to Senator Rob Portman about this this week. He's a moderate Republican from Ohio who's not up for election this year and has been talked about as a potential sort of dark horse presidential contender. And he believes very strongly that his party needs to get its act together to present an affirmative agenda for 2016, that if they are going to be competitive in the next presidential election, they are going to have to, particularly if they get control of the Senate, show America that they can govern. They are going to have to prove to people like this caller that they are not just obstructionists. They're going to have to set forward a set of policies that can convince a very skeptical public that they are good for something besides just opposing the president. So that is another incentive for Republicans, particularly if they take the Senate, to come to the table to be more constructive than they have been for the past 6 years.
Lots of headlines out there this week. Pentagon saying climate change is a real national security threat right now. That kind of washed over by Ebola and everything else this week. Joe Biden's son kicked out of the Navy Reserve because of failed the cocaine and drug test. And this just in, Nigeria and Boko Haram, the word here that they have agreed on a ceasefire and that those schoolgirls that were abducted will be released. I wonder if that's even possible, if they're really around and together any longer. Kristen, here we are. What a moment. Is the president having any sense of satisfaction? What's going on here? Ebola doesn't look like any fun. The Middle East doesn't look like any fun. Where's the light the president wants to talk about?
I don't think there's any sense of satisfaction. If you think about where President Obama wanted to be at this very moment when he was reelected in 2012, he wanted to be pushing through immigration reform. He wanted to be talking about climate control. But those things have largely gotten shelved as they deal with these incoming crises like ISIS, like now Ebola. And it seems like his agenda continues to get pushed back. You also have an attorney general that he needs to name.
Yeah.
And if Republicans do win the Senate, it's going to make it that much more difficult for him to get his candidate of choice through the nominating process.
Well, lots of big challenges there. Jack Beatty, you know, even a great power has to have its fundamentals in order to handle crises when they come, Jack.
Indeed, and it has to have the confidence of the people that it can handle those crises. And I think both in the fact, handling them, and in the confidence, the administration has not performed.
Been a rough week, been a rough series of weeks. We thank all three of you for looking at this one with us today. Molly Ball at The Atlantic, always great to have you. Thank you, Molly.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
Kristen Welker at NBC News. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
And Jack, as always, our thanks to you.
Thank you.
This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.